You're listening to Dairy Voice by Dairy Business News, a podcast exclusively for the dairy industry.
One of our sponsors of the Dairy Voice podcast is National DHIA. NDHIA ensures information accuracy and represents their members' interests. They are the direct voice for the dairy information industry. To find out more, go to dhia.org.
Dairy One's Soil Laboratory provides a variety of industries with soil testing and analysis. For most of our customers, their businesses literally start from the ground up. A soil analysis will help our customers ensure that the right nutrients are available in the soil or if additional fertilizers are needed. These decisions will impact their plant growth and yield. If you need to improve your soil's health, Dairy One is ready to help. Contact the Dairy One Soil Laboratory by emailing soil@dairyone.com. That's dairyone.com.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are at in your day. Welcome to the Dairy Voice podcast by Dairy Business News. I'm your host today, Connie Cooper with Seal Pro Silage Barrier Film and Connor AgriScience. I recorded an episode about silage harvest planning with Eric Dorr of Stillwater Animal Technologies. Because there is so much great info here, we decided to split the recording into part one and part two. So buckle up. Here's part one. So speaking of silage, by now you've opened up and are well into your 2023 crop. So how is it looking? Today's topic is setting goals for the 2024 harvest and planning ahead. You might think, well, it's too early for that. I just got done with harvest, it seems like. But as we look at our operations and the price of corn silage, it's important that we get it right. So in planning should start happening now. Today, I'm pleased to welcome my guest, Eric Dorr of Stillwater Animal Technologies in Nampa, Idaho. Welcome to the Dairy Voice podcast, Eric. You've got a wealth of information to share.
Well, thank you, Connie. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm excited to do this. I've never done a podcast before, so we'll hope I don't mess it up too badly. That's why they have edit buttons on these things, right?
I'm sure you'll do great.
I've been involved in the silage industry a little over 20 years now, started in my career in Nebraska, was working with a manufacturer of silage inoculants there, worked Nebraska, the High Plains into Colorado, down into Texas, and then had an opportunity to move to Idaho about 17 years ago, and that's when I originally started Stillwater Animal Technologies. So I was working with some silage products then and some other animal health and nutrition products across the Northwest primarily, and then came across a product that was the first oxygen barrier product, a product called SiloStop. And I was the first person west of the Mississippi River to import that. And of course, that's how I became intimately involved, I guess, at the time. Was it even Connor AgriScience at the time?
It was Connor Marketing.
Yeah. Connor Marketing. Yeah. Okay. Right. So I knew it was somewhere in there working with you and your husband, Ron, mm-hmm. on getting SiloStop at that point in time into California, which is, of course, changed. And after doing that for many years, worked with a few other animal nutrition companies, mostly focused in the Northwest. And then for the last 8 or so years was working for a European company that was in the silage manufacturing business or silage inoculant manufacturing business, Christian Hansen. And worked in their technical support division, worked in business development, traveled all over the Northern Hemisphere, still haven't crossed the equator yet. Got to spend a lot of time in Europe, spent a lot of time across North America, went as far as Russia to do consultations. And really what I, really enjoy doing is getting on farm, seeing what producers are doing, seeing challenges, issues, problems that they might be having in their silage programs, and then offering consultation advice, information, et cetera, to help them, improve so that we don't have those same things happen in the future. How do we always work and focus on continual process improvement?
Right. I've been with you on farm. You do a great job of talking to people and trying to go through what it is there, what they have been doing, what they can do better. And I think that's always really appreciated. So that's what you've done in the past. What are you doing now?
Well, so I in December, I decided there was just a good opportunity. A good friend of ours who's no longer with us, Dr. Keith Bolson, was a really good mentor of mine and learned a lot working with Keith over the years. And this was something that he always used to provide, right? For late in his career, Keith spent a lot of time doing on-farm consulting and stuff, but he's no longer with us. And I just saw that there was an opportunity for this. So in December, I started a company called Silage Consulting International. And launched a website called silagematters.com. So you can go there and learn a little bit more about what we do. And I have a partner in that business now as an agronomist. So whether he can come out and help on agronomy things, obviously pre-harvest, growing the crop, more his specialty. And he's got 25 plus years as a professional agronomist focused on forage, which is very unique. My expertise is to come in at the harvest level, planning how we're going to harvest, when we're going to harvest, what are we going to do with it, how are we going to store it. All these things are so critical to profitability long term on the farm. I mean, we're looking at feed costs, 60-70% of the cost of operating a dairy today. And if we don't focus on that, it's just this, it's a hidden cost there that's there. And I think the advantage that I can kind of help bring to people is because I go to so many places and go to see so many different ways that people do it, both right and wrong, that I can learn from that and go, okay, here's an opportunity. Because I think the people on the local farm, they just, you hear it a lot. This way we've always done it.
Right.
Well, maybe that's not the best way to do it. Or maybe it's completely wrong. And a lot of times it is completely wrong. And you can see that because you can see, black feed that's steaming and, it's like, gosh, we're making compost instead of making silage. And of course, if we're doing that, we know we're losing a tremendous amount of money.
Right.
And so if we can make a few changes in the program that kind of tweak the program so we don't have those issues. But, a lot of it comes down to education. It comes down to just asking questions and understanding what it is they're capable of. I go to Mexico and gosh, for the first, I usually spend about a month a year in Mexico. And the first couple of years that I was going to Mexico, this is like a decade ago, I'd always focus on compact, we talk about packing density, right? But they'd say compaction. Right. And we'd always focus on, how do we improve the compaction? And then we realized they have small tractors. They don't have 500 horsepower, duly articulated, tractors like what we would consider in the Western U.S. as a packing tractor. They just don't have them. Mm-hmm. So we got to realize, okay, that's a limitation they're always going to have just based on the physical properties of the equipment that they have to work with. They've got more field tractors because they've got smaller fields and that's what they pack with. For the most part, there's two or three farms that I've been on that aren't that way. But, the general rule is they just don't have big packing tractors. So why are we going to focus on compaction? Okay, we need to understand the basics of it and we need to move on to the thing. What can they actually make an effect on? Mm-hmm. And of course, that can come down to choosing when to harvest, what dry matter to harvest at, what maturity to harvest at. Are they going to inoculate? What are they going to inoculate with? Are they going to cover? What are they going to cover with? How are they going to seal it up? All those things, those are, more controllable variables that they can decide with the management. I like to tell people that silage is easy. It's the people that mess it up.
Yeah. Well, silage is easy, and but it's so, so complicated.
Transform dairy data from numbers into valuable decision-making information with HerdHQ, the ultimate web-based platform brought to you by DRMS. Leverage advanced analytics, benchmarking, and alert systems to optimize productivity, minimize costs, and improve herd health. If you're part of the beef on dairy movement, check out Keeper Beef. Love your iPhone or iPad? CowCompass will provide you with extensive animal and herd information, no matter what type of device you use. Do you like charts and graphs? Check out Dairy Depot, with over 100 charts and tables. HerdHQ is available to all herds that process their DHI data with DRMS. Don't miss out on this game-changing dairy management solution. Contact DRMS today to schedule a demo.
So when you go in to see a client, what goals do you set? How do you go in and consult with somebody? I'm certain you look at their silage plan the way it is. Maybe you take into consideration the where they're at, what their capabilities are as far as equipment. So what is it that you look at?
Yeah, I like to start looking at both the forages, but then also the feed center. It's one of the common issues I see is that, a farm was built whenever it was, call it 20, 30 years ago, and it was a 1,000-cow farm, for example. Well, now they're 2,000 cows. Mm-hmm. Well, they built more barns and they adjusted the parlor. And what's the last thing that they do is affect the feed center, right? And they're still working in a lot of cases. You know, this is a very common issue I see there. So they're still working in the same, you know, small box. And we always say we've got to think outside of a box, but then we never do. We just shove more feet in the same box, and then we overflow the box, and then we have a lot of waste. And so a lot of it for me is looking at how do we effectively understand those kind of dynamics, and are we properly storing the feed the right way? One example I like to explain to people is like, I can go to the store on Monday and buy this really nice, high quality prime steak. But if I don't take care of it until I'm going to cook it on Friday night, and I just leave it out on the counter, what's it going to be like when I eat it, when I cook it on Friday night? Like, I really have to store it properly, right? And so I can start with the best material, but if I don't take care of it along the way, well, then this is the whole problem. And that's what we're doing with silage, right? We're trying to preserve this food. We always say feed, but I mean, we're trying to preserve this food and keep it fresh and clean and hygienic all the way from start to finish. And it's difficult to do if I don't have a good refrigerator to put it in.
Right.
And that's kind of the example. And if I'm going to put it in a refrigerator, well, I could put it on a plate, but I know I'd get best long-term storage, right? If I put it in a vacuum seal, which is an oxygen-free environment, which is the same thing we know to do with silages today, because we have oxygen barrier technology. Mm-hmm. Well, so why wouldn't we do that? That's what we would do with our food. We're going to feed our families. That's what we do with a block of cheese. Well, why don't we do that with our silages? We're going to feed our animals, right? And so kind of, so a lot of it's just like very basic, you know, kind of stuff, but we kind of miss out on that sometimes. So I like to start there. Look at, is the feed center capable of handling, you know, the types of feeds that we're bringing in? And I see more and more farms in different areas, you know, bringing in byproducts. Okay, well, that's fine and good, but do we have a place to segregate byproducts from our forages? And, you know, sometimes we see byproducts because of the condition that they come in, or they're seasonal. I know you guys deal with like carrots, right? In California,
right. Mm-hmm.
Well, we get carrots that come in and we got to put them there, and it's just a temporary seasonal thing, but, and that's great. But sometimes we end up using it like a bunker that was designed for some longer term storage forage. And it's like, well, then where are we going to put the forage on a certain day? Well, what's it going to be a month from now? Or what was it a month ago? You know, mm-hmm. when we had snow a month ago, or a month from now, it's going to be a rainy season, or we're going to bring a byproduct in because that's when it grows or it's available. So just trying to understand all of that first and foremost, because to me, it's kind of like the central nervous system, or the heart, if you will, of the farm. And if it's not working right, then, well, then making the feed to get to the cows, to get the milk production and all that, you know, it starts to break down. It's that weak link. Once you get an understanding of that, really asking a lot of questions, and you know, mentioned it, was like, what are the equipment factors? How do they harvest? What do they harvest with? When do they harvest? What are their goals? Why do they set those? And really trying to understand, all right, what, you know, part of it is, well, what are they capable of? What level of management do they have? What equipment do they have disposal to? You know, that helps kind of shape, if you will. You know, it's one thing to have a, you know, I don't know, a big chopper, but if we're don't have enough trucks to handle the, you know, the volume that machine can chop. So it's like, well, how do we deal with that? What are the distances that we're traveling from fields to the feed center? And maybe not the best word, but a holistic approach to try to understand first and foremost, what are we dealing with? What are we capable of doing? And then it's like, okay, where would you like to go with your farm?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, because some of them go, well, I don't know. You tell me how I get better. It's like, well, what's your definition of what is better? There's a lot, you know, that goes into that too. I was on a farm in New York one time, and this is like 4 or 5 years ago, and the guy had a lot of problems. He had last year's corn silage butted up against this year's corn silage problem. Super safety problem. Hate it. I've never seen it work. I've always seen high rots. You know, some of the guys say, like, you see it in the East a lot where they'll cut down the side of, they call it cutting down the bunk. Like, well, that's because you didn't build the bunker correctly for the number of cows you have and the feed that you have. But so they're slicing down the side of this bunk, and you have this whole bunch of rot and everything like that. And then they stack next year's feed against it. And I've never seen it work. I've been to a lot of farms. I've never seen it work. And it's like, mm-hmm. you know, I ask them, I said, so why do you do it like this? Well, that's what we have to do. I was like, well, it never works. So why do you do it?
Right.
And I would say, don't do that again. But anyway, this particular farm had all of these problems like that. And because he had just expanded so much, you know, cow herd was so big, feed center didn't grow with the cow herd expansion. And I get why it happens. I, you know, I'm not naive to it, but he had all the experts supposedly that had told him how to fix it. Well, they told him how to build like the perfect feed center to handle the feed for 10,000 cows. It's like, what they didn't look at is like, well, if you just move maybe the first week's production of corn silage or the last week's, whichever one's kind of more troublesome because it's either wetter or drier, like you got to look at those things. maybe we just move a little bit of that. And then that starts to take the pressure off of the whole feed center. So then I don't have as much room that I'm dedicated to this. And so, you know, you bag some of that feed, or you don't normally make a drive over pile in that area, but you know, we have to, because we have to work ourselves out of the problem. The real problem was he never had a clean area that if he wanted to build a new feed center there or expand the pad, if you will, how is he going to do that? There was always feed there, you know, just trying to think again, thinking outside of the box and looking at, you know, ideas of like, we don't need to fix all of it, but how can we fix a portion of it? And how will that relieve the pressure on some of this other feed elsewhere? Well, and what happens? Well, we get safer feed, right? Because it's not stacked so high, and we get less rots because we're feeding through it faster. And
well, and a lot of times too, we'll, and I know that I've seen this on a farm when I was with you too, is that somebody's got, as far as expanding a feed center, making room for more silage, they've got a pile of rust out there that's sitting someplace close to the dairy and opening people's eyes to the land availability that they do have can really make a big difference.
Yeah, well, you know, the way to think about it, and you start seeing those types of problems, hot feeds, black feeds, rotten feed. I mean, they're clearly rotten, right? They just call them compost. It's really simple. Those are 25 to 35% kind of shrink losses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's like growing 100 acres and throwing 25 to 30 acres away. And people say, well, I don't have room to put up another pile. You have room to throw away 30 acres of feed?
Right.
20 acres of feed? Take 2 acres of that mm-hmm. and build a pad to put 10%, 20%, whatever fits there, you know, and it's got to fit there safely and all that stuff. But, you know, you have more room than you think. And like I said, that rust pile, you mm-hmm. know, why are we storing these old, you know, implements that don't run anymore, that we don't use anymore, and, you know, collecting junk around here? Like, let's get that stuff cleaned out. And in the past, when feed was cheaper,
yeah,
maybe you'd say, well, you know, I can deal with that level of shrink or you know, losses. Today, I don't have a crystal ball, but I don't see it coming down. I mean, yeah, we've seen the corn board move a little bit this year, but long term, you know, mm-hmm. they always say God's not making any more dirt. Like, where are we going to grow these crops? And you know, are we going to see the, you know, phenomenal jumps in yields that we've made over the last century, incredible yield improvements. Are we going to double the amount of, you know, yields on corn silage per acre? Probably not.
Right.
You know, so we've got to get to where, how are we most effectively storing and managing the resource that we have to minimize our losses? And then there's a lot of, you know, financial benefits to it. There's environmental benefits to it. There's health benefits to the cows. There's all these things that, you know, that come in here to play. And for me, I just like, how do we take what we have and do a better job at it? And I think most people want to do that, but they just don't either know how, or haven't been exposed to it enough, or they have the "this is how we've always done it" mentality. Or when you think about that example of just, you know, how much is your loss, and how equated back to how much land do you farm?
Right.
You know, and then you go, okay, well, maybe I do have space for this stuff.
When you ask them what they think, they think is their shrink factor in a pot. What do you tell people is the shrink factor just for fermentation alone?
Oh, fermentation alone. If we have a fast, efficient fermentation, and this is documented by tons of research, tons of companies, everybody looking at, I mean, there's tons of farmers get inundated with treated versus untreated, for example. That alone, and just looking at fermentation losses in many silos, generally is when it's done. So about as perfect as you could do one, which isn't real world. If you don't inoculate with anything, you'll lose roughly 8 to 10% with a dry matter. And if you do inoculate with a good product, say, call it, cut it in half, 4 or 5%.
Sure.
So that's just saying, if I make a perfect mini silo, I'm still going to lose 5% of it. Right. And I've made thousands and thousands of mini silos in buckets, tubes, you know, you name it, vacuum seal bags. And you're literally taking the feed and immediately putting it in there, sealing it, taking the oxygen out of it, done. And it takes minutes.
Yeah.
And yet we're taking weeks to build some of these piles. Mm-hmm. So if you start thinking of it that way, I mean, I think the top 5% of the producers, forage producers, are barely single digit shrink. And I'm talking 8, 9, 10%. I think that they're very fortunate and they are doing everything correct. And they also get the benefit that Mother Nature didn't slam them in the middle. You know, they like that has to occur too. And that's a variable we can't control.
Right.
You take any forage that gets rained on during the middle of the harvest. I know it never happens where you live, but maybe up here in Idaho, sometimes we'll have a chopper breakdown. And so we're chopping with, you know, or a truck breakdown, or a truck driver didn't show up for work. You know, all of those things, you know, start to slow down our process.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, slow is also safe. So it's like, I'm not suggesting we go 100 miles an hour, but all of these things are important. But any little thing in there, you know, we know we're losing a couple percent here and a couple percent there. And then we just look at how people feed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're losing a few percent there. And honestly, I mean, our losses are greater on the back end than they ever are on the front end. Fermenting feed up front is actually fairly simple. It's very basic. We've been doing it for thousands of years, but we've gotten really good at it the last, you know, two decades. Looking at what we call in the industry aerobic stability and keeping feeds from preventing them from heating on the back end and using oxygen barrier technologies and things like this, like SealPro, are just so critical to minimizing that shrink on the back end. The experts would say, and I'd agree, I mean, you know, there's 10 to 15% of lost opportunity once we open that pile up, because now it is exposed to oxygen and it's exposed to oxygen until it's all gone.
Yes.
And it's a daily fight against it wanting to reheat and recompost or start to compost.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the bigger fight. Now, luckily, there's great technologies out there today that handle that. But producers have to be willing to accept them and utilize them and utilize them correctly. Otherwise, they just don't work. You know, one thing I've really focused a lot on too is that, you know, I believe in this inoculant technology. I think there's some fantastic products out there that really do control this, you know, secondary reheating. And we call it aerobic stability. We know how those products work and they work well, but only if we apply them correctly.
Right.
Only if we mix them the way the manufacturer says to, and only if we keep the temperature down. You know, that's one of the reasons I created, you know, my website, Silage Matters, is like all of these things matter. You know, dry matter matters, right? The maturity matters, safety matters, application matters, inoculation matters, covering matters, all, you know, packing matters, all these things matter to the quality. But if we skip on one step, there's no way we're going to hit single digit. And when I'm saying single digit, I'm thinking that's just under 10, you know, 9%. There's no way we do that. We skimp on things.
Not going to happen.
And I'm not suggesting we spend money necessarily always. It's investing our money in the right technologies to get us where we want to. If I buy that prime steak on Monday, if I don't take care of it till Friday, I don't care how good the you know, the quality of the meat was on Monday, it will not be good come Friday.
Have you run out of silage? Had to buy expensive, marked up feed to fill the gap? Maybe production's dropped due to lower dry matter intakes. Are molds or mycotoxins creeping through your piles or bunkers? And pitching the rot is a dangerous pain. Oxygen is the enemy. Pack it out, then keep it out with SealPro, the professional grade silage barrier film protection chosen by top professional farmers like you. Make more, better, safer silage with SealPro. Learn more at sealprosilage.com.
So if I'm planning my harvest, I'm going to start now and I'm going to try to figure out where I'm going to put all this feed. I'm going to figure out how much feed I'm going to need every day, what my face is going to feed off. I'm going to move out some rusted equipment if I need to, and maybe make a silage pad someplace or take a field of that's adjacent to the place and that I've got corn growing in, and instead make a silage pad out of it. What else should I be doing as far as planning ahead?
Well, and I think this is where you need to work with a local agronomist. Of course, we have a, you know, agronomist with Silage Matters, but that really understands how crops grow, what the season trends, those kind of things. Like, who am I to come into, Texas or New York and try to tell you what crops are going to grow there, right? I'm not there enough. So I think that's a real critical point. But what's going to happen this spring? Can we plant a little earlier this spring than previous years? You know, all of those things, I think, come into play. One of the things I run into, at least, you know, in my home area here in Idaho, is, you know, we pretty much have a simple near the dairy trit corn rotation. if you want to call it a rotation, right? It's not a rotation, it's a flip-flop, right? But that's what we grow. And that makes sense. But I've seen producers that have, you know, well, we got to get, you know, maximum yield out of this triticale. And you go, okay, well, at what cost? And sometimes in May, that works fine. And I'll just pull a number out of there, but we can chop triticale, you know, on Cinco de Mayo, and we can be planting corn a couple of days later, and that works good. But what if it rains in that time frame? Because that's happened to us a couple of times, maybe three out of the last 5 years or so. Now, all of a sudden, I can't get my triticale harvested when I want to. It's a little bit, now it's even more mature, and it was already going for dry matter yield, right? So it's a pretty darn mature crop to begin with. Now it's 2 more weeks. Now my corn's behind. And what's that going to cause me in September? You know, I want to chop, and again, just pull the numbers out of the air, but Labor Day, and all of a sudden it's the 20th of September when I get started.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm using a custom harvester and he's only going to be in the neighborhood at this particular time. And so I don't have any choice. And now my corn's not mature enough and I harvest it too early and I'm harvesting more sugar water than starch and I've left dry matter yield in the field. Like there's a lot of issues that are with that. So, you know, there's a lot of things that go into this planning of the planting as well. So, you know, I like to simplify it to that corn is king. So let's focus everything around corn and these secondary crops. I know you guys call it winter forage or you know, for us, it's triticale, whatever that looks like. I'll sacrifice the yield on that crop to make sure that I have a good corn crop. And we've seen it here too. We've had a few years lately where we've had the opportunity. We could have gone in and harvested that triticale in April. And of course, yes, we didn't get the yield of it, but we got a much more digestible, highly nutritious, high sugar content, could actually make milk with it instead of dry cow heifer feed kind of scenario. And we could have got corn in the ground a little bit earlier. I had a couple of guys that did that and they hit home runs and they missed that. You know, we didn't have to actually put water on, which isn't normal for us. You know, they didn't have to start watering a crop until June. Well, now it's like V7, V8 because they got it planted in late April, where normally we would plant it mid-May. So there's a lot of advantages to, you know, really understanding. And again, some of that I think's being willing to call an audible and take a risk, because it can also be risky planting it in April, because it's not uncommon that we get some snow. It snowed here just the other day and it was 60 degrees last week. So,
yeah,
you know, again, those are tough decisions farms got to make. And so I just want to get them to think about those things, and maybe there's some opportunity there, not just doing it the way we've always done it, but what's it look like that's going to make sense for this year?
Well, and maybe spreading your risk and planting some different day long, some different days, just to cover your bases.
But I saw a scenario last year where we had spider mites come in.
Oh yeah.
Right around Labor Day. Mm-hmm. And in theory, we still had another week, 10 days. Those mites hit it. And even though it got sprayed, we didn't get the timing right or caught, you know, catch them at the right time. And, boy, by Labor Day, that stuff was 45, 50% dry matter.
Mm.
We should have chopped it in the end of August, and that's not normal for us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're talking about kind of like pre-harvest planting, planning, but it's like, boy, when we're the closer we're getting to you know, go, the more we've got to be scouting and paying attention. And because I'm at, you know, it's not uncommon that we harvest some corn silage that comes in at 40 or 50 dry matter at the end of the season, but starting with that on day one.
Right.
Ouch. Sure. Now, of course, that was just a certain, you know, few fields that happened on, but like now it absolutely has to go, or we call another audible and like, well, do we leave that, rotate to some other fields and make a plan to now make high moisture corn out of that, or a snaplage or an earlage, or, you know, or let it go all the way dry and we'll just, but I don't have a combine. So there's all of those things that kind of come into play too, but we could shell that corn. Do we have a feed center that gives us a flexibility to where we can store an extra crop and, you know, an audible crop? So I was with some clients in New York. We're going to try something this spring where we're going to have a small bunk for grass silage that, you know, when they get going, they can't stop. And if these loads are too wet, you know, we'll make our criteria what too wet is. Those go in this other bunk. We're going to, you know, get them in this bunk. We're going to not, if you will, contaminate, because we know when we get really wet feeds, we have different, you know, a lot of issues there, high dry matter losses, issues for, you know, more butyric production, clostridial growth, those kind of things. So rather than contaminate the whole bunker, let's just have this little flex bunker. Let's put the most extreme loads in it right away.
Mm-hmm.
you know, because we can make a lot of milk on this grass silage, but not if we have these bands of, you know, really funky forage in there. But so let's isolate that to a small area, and then we'll feed that flex bunk up right away before it has a long time to, you know, become a problem for us. So kind of some strategies like that too is another thing that, you know, trying to bring ideas to people to look at. So
yeah, that's interesting. I never thought about that before, but that's a great
it's not a common problem in the West.
Yeah.
Sure can be in the Northeast.
It can be here though. I mean, it could be.
No, I think it's just like, it's kind of an advantage that I think I bring because I see these different things, and you know, most of them aren't ideas I come up with. They're ideas I borrow, which is a nice way of saying steal from good farmers that I've seen and good producers all across, you know, the Northern Hemisphere. And you start putting them in the memory bank and then realizing like, okay, this I've seen this work before. I've seen this not work before.
Preparing for equipment needs and maintenance and that kind of thing this time of year. Does that figure into
plan? Yeah, super critical, right? And I think we finally gotten out of it, but this whole supply chain thing caused by COVID was it was almost so bad we've all forgotten how bad it was. It was like this bad nightmare, but getting parts and getting them there in a timely manner, in a cost-effective manner and everything like that. I mean, what a disaster that was. I even know one large farm up here that they just basically, they took one of the choppers and stripped it for parts to make sure they could fix the other three.
Wow.
Because otherwise they weren't going to get to go because this was missing. They couldn't get that part in time. All this stuff come and ship from, you know, mostly from Europe, from Germany and stuff. You know, what an extreme strategy to have to do, but it kept them in the game. And sometimes that's the name of the game, especially on these really big farms, is being able to go and to be able to go on time. Because if you miss that window, well, then there goes the whole summer. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll be facing, at least in this area, that early spring triticale harvest and then first cutting alfalfa while we're also planting corn. So there's a lot of things going on here. Mm-hmm. And getting ahead of the maintenance issues is absolutely critical. I haven't heard, at least from my client base, the extreme shortage of parts and those kinds of things. And I think maybe we've also done a better job in general. All of us have for whatever needs we have of planning ahead to get them, because not everything, you know, chopper parts don't come from Amazon. They don't show up in 2 days, you know.
That'd be nice, so, wouldn't it?
Yeah, maybe it would be nice.
Hey, maybe that's something we ought to get into is Amazon.
I guess.
AmazonChopperParts.com.
Yeah. Well, I did see that one time they'd hauled some hay for people. So who knows? Maybe they'll become a logistics partner for ag equipment. But, you know, they'll be like every other place. They'll have everything you need except for the one thing you need.
Yeah. right.
Yeah. When you need it. So I think one of the most difficult things about the whole process is cows never take a day off. You know, as you know, it's 365, 24/7. The cows don't get to take consistent.
And they want things the same all the time.
Yeah. All the time. And that's when
every day. Yeah.
Yeah. That's when animal health and production meet their maximum and the cows are comfortable and all these things that, you know, we all talk about, but it's all of these outside, you know, variables that we're always juggling and working around. We can't afford to not get it right because cows, you know, they'll suffer. And so will we as a result, but you know, I don't know a single dairy producer that wants to see their cows suffer.
Right. No.
And so when you think about all of that, like that's the key to everything. And we know that is, it's like, that's why all of these things are so critical that we get them right ahead of time. So something as simple as making sure we have the right, you know, bearings for a particular, you know, piece of equipment trickles down to whether we get feed harvested at the right, you know, quality level, right dry matter that we want it to then it going into the silo, to then eventually getting into the TMR in front of that bunk. And, you know, it's like, you think about it that way, it's like, man, every little step is just so important that we try to get it right.
What about planning for labor needs?
What labor? Where do you find it right now? So, I've got some clients that are doing a lot with H2A workers coming from Mexico, but, there's certain they can't do functions on the dairy, right? So they're on the harvest crew. They're doing truck driving and things like that. And they're permitted to do that. And that seems to be working pretty well. But boy, is it a lot of work to get it done.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, you know, good quality people that want to come, that want to work. I actually have a friend down in Mexico that's trying to come for other reasons. And man, it's just really hard to get legally across the border. And so those are issues. Not every crew, a lot of times it's family members and those things. What I see most commonly is when, you know, you think of the true, if you will, family farm, and, you know, the cousins, the brothers, the uncles, the sisters, the, you know, everybody's involved in this. Somebody has to be empowered to make some of these decisions, especially when we get caught with, okay, now what, you know, something broke down. God forbid somebody got hurt and we're short a person. Yeah, you know, the weather changed, those kinds of things. So it gets difficult working in a family business with, you know, sometimes, but it, you know, somebody needs to be put in charge of that. Is everybody on the labor crew, whoever that be, you know, hired people or family crew, are they educated, trained, you know, you and I both believe up to date on the most current safety information, right? Because it's a dangerous business out here. Yeah. And it's amazing how many times we throw a fairly inexperienced person, one, into a very expensive piece of equipment, whatever that is, a truck or a chopper, a tractor. But do they really understand beyond the mechanics of the equipment, the safety aspects of it and how the whole operation runs? It's a lot of risk involved in all of this. So, you know, I think it's very important that, you know, in the crews that I work with that I think are the most successful, take time ahead of time, right? We're doing training meetings in March and April and May and making sure people are up to date on how we're going to do things, why we're going to do things, all the safety aspects of that. Equipment's maintained to the best of our ability. Those are functions that are occurring now. And of course, if you're in California, you maybe already did that 2 months ago.
Yeah. In February, March, we talk about, hey, get everybody together and let's talk about it and do a few practice runs on some of that equipment. You know, you can't throw some, like you said, so you can't throw somebody up on a push tractor or a pack tractor and tell them to, you know, here we go. And here comes a whole bunch of trucks. And that person is trying to do the best job that they can, but they've never done it before today.
Yeah. Well, what Keith used to say, the, you know, the primary push blade tractor operator was the quarterback.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. At that feed center. And you know, a lot of truth in that too. So do you want a Tom Brady there? Or do you want a, you know, high school freshman first time starting a game, right?
Yep.
So
even if he was the star of the eighth grade team.
Yeah. Might've been, but, I think experience there might be important. That doesn't mean that those people can't do a good job, but
no.
You know, who is going to be the quarterback if that's the scenario.
And with that, we'll wrap up part one. I told you there'd be a lot of good ideas and tips from Eric Doerr. So please be sure to tune into part two, where we'll talk about inoculants and sealing. If you need to reach Eric in the meantime, you can find him on his website at silagematters.com. There's so much good information here. Be sure to subscribe, like, and share this episode of Dairy Voice Podcast by Dairy Business News.